lost the rest as gunfire erupted around us. The cycle, battered as it was, spun out and went down. Right onto the side where the gravitonics were broken. 30. Without the gravitonics, the cycle reacted like any normal motorcycle would when falling onto its side at very high speed, which isn't a good thing. I was immediately ripped free, the cycle skidding out from underneath me as my leg hit the ground and the friction pulled me backward. Megan wasn't so lucky. She got pinned under the cycle, its weight grinding her against the ground. It collided with the wall of the tubular steel corridor. The tunnel wavered, and my leg burned with pain. As I rolled to a halt and things stopped shaking, I realized that I was still alive. I actually found that surprising. Behind us, from an alcove we had driven past, two men in full enforcement armor stepped out of the shadows. There were some small, faint lights ringing the edge of the alcove. By that light, I could see that the soldiers looked relaxed. I swore I could hear one chuckling inside his helmet as he said something over the comm unit to his companion. They assumed Megan and I would both be dead, or at least knocked out of fighting shape by such a crash. To calamity with that, I thought, cheeks hot with anger. Before I'd had time to think, I'd unholstered the pistol under my arm, the pistol that had killed my father, and unloaded four shots at nearly point-blank range into the men. I didn't aim for their chests, not with their armor. The sweet spot was the neck. Both men fell. I breathed in a deep, ragged breath, my hand and gun shaking in front of me. I blinked a few times, shocked that I'd managed to hit them. Maybe Megan was right about handguns. I groaned, then managed to sit up. My Reckoner jacket was in tatters. Many of the diodes along its inside, the ones that generated the protective field, were smoking or entirely ripped free. My leg was scraped badly along one side. Though it hurt fiercely, the lacerations weren't too deep. I was able to stumble to my feet and walk. Kind of. The pain was rather unpleasant. Megan! The thought came through the daze, and stupid though it was, I didn't check to see if the two soldiers were actually dead. I limped over to where the fallen cycle had skidded up against the wall. The only light here was from my mobile. I pushed aside the wreckage and found Megan sprawled beneath, her jacket in even worse shape than mine. She didn't look good. She wasn't moving. Her eyes were closed, and her helmet was cracked, only halfway on. Blood trailed down her cheek. It was the color of her lips. Her arm was twisted at an awkward angle, and her entire side, leg up to torso, was bloodied. I knelt, aghast, the cool, calm light of my mobile revealing horrible wounds everywhere I turned it. David? Tia's voice came softly from my mobile, which hung in its place from my jacket. It was a miracle it still functioned, though I'd lost my earpiece. David, I can't reach Megan. What's going on? Megan's down, I said numbly. Her mobile is gone, shattered probably. It had been attached to her jacket, which was mostly gone also. Breathing. I have to see if she's breathing. I leaned down, trying to use my mobile screen to catch her breath. Then I thought to check for a pulse. I'm in shock. I'm not thinking right. Could you think that when you were thinking right? I pressed my fingers against Megan's neck. The skin felt clammy. David, Tia said urgently. David, there's chatter on the enforcement channels. They know where you are. There are multiple units converging on you, infantry and armor. Go! I felt a pulse, shallow, light, but there. She's alive, I said. Tia, she's alive.
You have to get out of there, David.
Moving Megan could make things worse for her, but leaving her would definitely make things worse. If they took her, she'd be tortured and executed. I pulled off my tattered jacket and used it to wrap my leg. As I worked, I felt something in the pocket. I pulled it out. the pen detonator and blasting caps. In a moment of lucidity, I stuck one of the blasting caps on the cycle's fuel cell. I'd heard you could destabilize and blow those if you knew what you were doing, which I didn't. It seemed like a good idea, though. My only idea. I took my mobile and attached it to my wrist mount. Then, sucking in a deep breath, I shoved aside the broken motorcycle, the front wheel had been ripped clean off, and lifted Megan. Her broken helmet slipped free, falling off and cracking against the ground. That made her hair cascade down over my shoulder. She was heavier than she looked. People always are. Though she was small, she was compact. Dense. I decided she'd probably not like hearing me describe her that way. I got her up over my shoulders, then began an unsteady hike down the tunnel. Tiny yellow lights hung from the ceiling periodically, giving barely enough light to see by, even for an understreeter like me. Soon my shoulders and back were complaining. I kept on going, one foot after another. I wasn't moving very quickly. I wasn't thinking very well either.
David,
Prof's voice. Quiet. Intense. I'm not leaving her, I said through clenched teeth.
I wouldn't have you do something like that, Prof said. I'd much sooner have you stand your ground and make enforcement gun you both down.
Not very comforting.
It's not going to come to that, son,
Prof said.
Help is on its way.
I think I can hear them, I said. I'd finally reached the end of the tunnel. It opened onto a narrow crossroads in the understreets. There were no buildings here, just steel corridors. I didn't know this part of town well. The ceiling was solid, with no gaps up to the air above, like there were in the area where I'd grown up. Those were definitely shouts I heard echoing from the right. I heard clanks from behind, steel feet pounding against the steel ground, more shouts. They'd found the cycle. I leaned up against the wall, shifting Megan's weight, then pressed the button on my pen detonator. I was relieved to hear a pop from behind as the cycle's fuel cell blew. The shouts rose. Maybe I'd caught a few of them in the blast. If I was really lucky, they'd assume I was hiding somewhere near the wreckage and had tossed a grenade or something. I hefted Megan, then took the left turn at the crossroads. Her blood had soaked my clothing. She was probably dead by... No, I wouldn't think about that. One foot in front of the other. Help was coming. Prof promised help was coming. It would come. Prof didn't lie. Jonathan Phaedrus, founder of the Reckoners, a man I somehow understood. If there was anything in this world I felt I could trust, it was him. I walked a good 5 minutes before I was forced to pull up short. The tunnel in front of me ended in a flat wall of steel. Dead end. I glanced over my shoulder to see flashlights and shadows moving. No escape that way. The corridor around me was wide, maybe 20 paces across, and tall. There was some old construction equipment on the ground, though most of it looked to have been picked over by opportunists. There were a few heaps of broken bricks and cinder blocks. Someone had been building more rooms down here recently. Well, those might provide some cover. I stumbled over and laid Megan down behind the largest of the piles. Then I flipped my mobile to manual response. Prof and the others wouldn't be able to hear me unless I touched the screen to broadcast. But it also meant they wouldn't give away my position by trying to contact me. I crouched down behind the bricks. The pile didn't give me complete cover, but it was better than nothing. Cornered, outgunned, with no way to... Suddenly, I felt like an idiot. I dug in the zip pocket on my trouser leg, fishing for my tensor. I pulled it out triumphantly. Maybe I could dig down to the steel catacombs, or even just dig out to the side and find a safer path. I pulled on the glove, and only then did I realize that the tensor had been shredded. I stared at it with a sinking despair. It had been in the pocket on the leg I'd landed on when falling, and the pouch had been ripped at the bottom. The tensor was missing two fingers, and the electronics had been shattered. pieces hanging off like eyes drooping out of a zombie's sockets in an old horror movie. I almost laughed as I settled back down. The enforcement soldiers were searching the corridors, shouts, footsteps, flashlights, getting closer. My mobile blinked softly. I turned the volume way down, then pressed the screen and leaned in. "David?" Tia asked in a very quiet voice. "David, where are you?" "I reached the bottom of the tunnel," I whispered back, holding the mobile up to my mouth. "I turned left."
"Left? That's a dead end. You need to..."
"I know," I said. "There were soldiers the other directions." I glanced at Megan, lying slumped on the floor. I tested her neck again. Still a pulse. I closed my eyes in relief. Not that it matters now.
"Calamity,"
Tia swore. I heard gunfire and jumped, thinking it was from my position. But it wasn't. It was from the line.
"Tia,"
I hissed.
"They're here," she said. "Don't worry about me. I can hold this place. David, you have to..."
"Hey, you!"
a voice called from the intersection. I ducked down, but the mound of bricks wasn't large enough to hide me completely, unless I was practically lying flat.
"There's someone over there,"
the voice shouted. Powerful enforcement-issue flashlights pointed my direction. Most of those would be on the ends of assault rifles. My mobile flashed. I tapped it.
"David,"
Prof's voice. He sounded winded.
"Use the tensor."
"Broken,"
I whispered.
"I ruined it in the crash."
Silence.
"Try it anyway,"
Prof urged.
"Prof, it's dead."
I peeked over the bricks. A large crowd of soldiers was gathering at the other end of the hall. Several were kneeling with guns pointed in my direction, eyes to scopes. I kept low.
"Just do it,"
Prof ordered. I sighed, then pressed my hand against the ground. I closed my eyes, but it wasn't easy to concentrate.
"Hold up your arms and walk forward slowly,"
a voice shouted down the hall toward me.
"If you do not show yourself, we will be forced to open fire."
I tried as best I could to ignore them. I focused on the tensor, on the vibrations. For a moment, I thought I felt something, a low hum. Deep, powerful. It was gone. This was stupid, like trying to saw a hole in a wall using only a bottle of soda. "Sorry, Prof," I said. "It's busted up good." I checked the magazine on my father's gun. 5 rounds left. 5 precious rounds that might be able to hurt Steelheart. I'd never have the chance to find out.
"You are running out of time, friend,"
the soldier called toward me.
"You have to hold out,"
Prof said urgently. His voice sounded frail with the volume down so low.
"You should go to Tia,"
I said, preparing myself.
"She'll be fine,"
Prof said.
"Abraham is on his way to help her, and the hideout was designed with an attack in mind. She can seal the entrance and wait them out. David, you must hang on long enough for me to arrive."
"I'll see that they don't take us alive, Prof," I promised.
"The safety of the Reckoners is more important than I am." I fished at Megan's side, getting out her handgun, and then flipping off its safety. Sig Sauer P226, 40 caliber. A nice gun.
"I'm coming, son,"
Prof said softly.
"Hold out."
I peeked up. The officers were advancing, guns raised. They probably wanted to take me alive. Well, maybe that would let me take a few of them out before I fell. I lifted Megan's gun and let loose a burst of rapid-fire shots. They had the intended effect. The officers scattered, seeking cover. Some fired back, and chips sprayed across me as bricks exploded to automatic weapon fire. Well, so much for hoping they wanted me alive. I was sweating. "Hell of a way to go, eh?" I found myself saying to Megan as I ducked around and fired on an officer who'd gotten too close. I think one of the bullets actually got through his armor. He was limping as he jumped behind a few rusty barrels. I hunkered down again, assault rifle fire sounding like firecrackers in a tin can. Which was, as I thought about it, kind of what this was. I'm getting better. I smiled wryly as I dumped the magazine from Megan's gun and locked a new one in. I'm sorry to let you down, I said to her immobile form. Her breathing had grown more shallow. You deserve to live through this, even if I didn't. I tried to fire off more rounds, but gunfire drove me back to cover before I could get off a single shot. I breathed hard, wiping some blood from my cheek. Some of the exploding rubble had hit hard enough to cut me. You know, I said, I think I fell for you that first day. Stupid, huh? Love at first sight. What a cliche. I got off 3 shots, but the soldiers were acting less scared now. They had figured out there was only one of me, and that my gun was only a handgun. I was probably only alive because I'd blown the cycle, which made them worry about explosives. I don't even know if I can call it love, I whispered, reloading. Am I in love? Is it just infatuation? We've known each other for less than a month, and you've treated me like dirt about half that time. But that day fighting Fortuity, and that day in the power plant, it seems like we had something. I don't know. Something together. Something I wanted. I glanced at her pale, motionless figure. I think, I said, that a month ago, I would have left you by the cycle, because I wanted so badly to get my vengeance on him. Bam, bam, bam! The pile of bricks shook, as if the officers were trying to cut through them to get to me. That scares me about myself, I said softly, not looking at Megan. For what it's worth, thank you for making me care about something other than Steelheart. I don't know if I love you, but whatever the emotion is, it's the strongest one I've felt in years. Thank you. I fired widely but fell back as a bullet grazed my arm. The magazine was empty. I sighed, dropping Megan's gun and raising my father's. Then I pointed it at her. My finger hesitated on the trigger. It would be a mercy. Better a quick death than to suffer torture and execution. I tried to force myself to pull the trigger. Ah, Sparks, she looks beautiful, I thought. Her unbloodied side was toward me, her golden hair fanning out, her skin pale and eyes closed as if asleep. Could I really do this? The gunshots had paused. I risked glancing over my crumbling pile of bricks. 2 enormous forms were mechanically clomping down the hallway. So they had brought in armor units. A piece of me felt proud that I was such a problem for them. The chaos of reckoners had caused this day, the destruction we'd brought to Steelheart's minions, had driven them to overkill. A squad of 20 men and 2 mechanized armors had been sent to take down 1 guy with a pistol. Time to die, I whispered. I think I'll do it while firing a handgun at a 15-foot-tall suit of powered armor. At least it will be dramatic. I took a deep breath, nearly surrounded by enforcement forms creeping forward in the dark corridor. I began to stand, my gun leveled at Megan more firmly this time. I'd shoot her, then force the soldiers to gun me down. I noticed that my mobile was blinking. Fire! A soldier yelled. The ceiling melted. I saw it distinctly. I was looking down the tunnel, not wanting to watch Megan as I shot her. I had a clear view of a circle in the ceiling becoming a column of black dust, cascading in a shower of disintegrated steel, like sand from an enormous spigot. The particles hit the floor and billowed outward in a cloud. The haze cleared. My finger twitched, but I had not pulled the trigger. A figure stood from a crouch amid the dust. He had fallen from above. He wore a black coat, thin like a lab coat, dark trousers, black boots, and a small pair of goggles over his eyes. Prof had come, and he wore a tensor on each hand, the green light glowing with a phantom cast. The officers opened fire, releasing a storm of bullets down the hallway. Prof raised his hand and thrust forward the glowing tensor. I could almost feel the device hum. Bullets burst in midair, crumbling. They hit Prof as little shavings of fluttering steel, no more dangerous than pinches of dirt. Hundreds of them pelted him and the ground around him. The ones that missed flew apart in the air, catching the light. Suddenly, I understood why he wore the goggles. I stood up, slack-jawed, gun forgotten in my fingers. I'd assumed I was getting good with my tensor. But destroying those bullets? That was beyond anything I'd been able to comprehend. Prof didn't give the baffled soldiers time to recover. He carried no weapon that I could see, but he leaped free of the dust and dashed right toward them. The mechanized units started firing, but they used their rotary guns as if they couldn't believe what they'd seen and figured a higher caliber was the answer. More bullets popped in the air, shattered by Prof's tensors. His feet skidded across the ground on the dust, and then he reached the enforcement troops. He attacked fully armored men with his fists. My eyes widened as I saw him drop a soldier with a fist to the face, the man's helmet melting to powder before his attack. He's vaporizing the armor as he attacks. Prof spun between two soldiers, moving gracefully, slamming a fist into the gut of one, then spinning and slamming an arm into the leg of the other. Dust sprayed out as their armor failed them, disintegrating just before Prof hit. As he came up from the spin, he pounded a hand against the side of the steel chamber. The pulverized metal poured away, and something long and thin fell from the wall into his hand. A sword, carved from the steel by an incredibly precise tensor blast. Steel flashed as Prof struck at the disordered officers. Some tried to keep firing. The others were going in with batons, which Prof destroyed just as easily as he had the bullets. He wielded the sword in one hand, and his other hand sent out near-invisible blasts that reduced metal and Kevlar to nothing. Dust streamed off soldiers who got too close to him, making them slip and stumble. Suddenly unbalanced as helmets melted around their heads and body armor fell away. Blood flew in front of high-powered flashlights, and men collapsed. It had been mere heartbeats since Prof had dropped into the room, but a good dozen of the soldiers were down. The armored units had drawn their shoulder-mounted energy cannons, but Prof had gotten too close. He hit a patch of steel dust at a sprint, then slid in a crouch forward, moving on the dust with obvious familiarity. He twisted to the side and swung his forearm, smashing through the armored unit's leg. Powder sprayed out the back as Prof's arm passed completely through it. He slid to a stop, still on one knee. The armor collapsed with a resounding thud as Prof leaped forward and drilled his fist through the second armor's leg. He pulled his hand out and the leg bent, then snapped, the unit collapsing sideways. It fired a yellow-blue blast into the ground as it fell, melting a portion of the floor. One foolhardy member of enforcement tried to charge Prof, who stood over the fallen armors. Prof didn't bother with the sword. He dodged to the side, then slammed his fist forward. I could see the fist approach the soldier's face, could see the helmet's visor vaporizing just in front of Prof's punch. The soldier dropped. The hallway grew silent. Sparkling steel flakes floated in beams of light like snow at midnight.
I, Prof said in a powerful, self-assured voice, am known as Limelight. Let your master know that I am more than aggravated by being forced to bother myself with you worms. Unfortunately, my minions are fools and are incapable of following the simplest of orders. Tell your master that the time for dancing and playing is through. If he does not come to face me himself, I will dismantle this city piece by piece until I find him.
Prof strode past the remaining soldiers without sparing them a glance. He walked toward me, his back to the soldiers. I grew tense, waiting for them to try something, but they didn't. They cowered. Men did not fight epics. They had been taught this, had it drilled into them. Prof reached me, face shrouded in shadows, light shining from behind. That was genius, I said softly.
Get the girl.
I can't believe that you... Prof looked at me, and I finally caught sight of his features. Jaw clenched, eyes seeming to blaze with intensity. There was contempt in those eyes, and the sight of it caused me to stumble back in shock. Prof seemed to be shaking, his hands forming fists, as if he were holding back something terrible.
Get the girl.
I nodded dumbly, stuffing my gun back in my pocket and picking up Megan. John? Tia's voice came from his mobile. Mine was still on silent. John, the soldiers have pulled out from my position. What's going on? Prof didn't reply. He waved a tensored hand and the ground before us melted away. The dust drained like sand in an hourglass, revealing an improvised tunnel to the lower levels below. I followed him through the tunnel, and we made our escape.
Part 4. 31.
Abraham, more blood,
Tia said, working with a frantic urgency. Abraham, his arm in a sling, which was stained red with his own blood, hastened to the cooler. Megan lay on the steel conference table in the main room of our hideout. Stacks of paper and some of Abraham's tools lay on the floor where I'd swept them. Now I sat to the side, feeling helpless, exhausted, and terrified. Prof had burrowed us a path into the hideout from the back. The front entrance had been sealed by Tia, using some metal plugs and a special type of incendiary grenade. I didn't understand much of what Tia was doing as she worked on Megan. It involved bandages and attempts to stitch wounds. Apparently, Megan had internal injuries. Tia found those even more distressing than the huge amounts of blood Megan had lost. I could see Megan's face. It was turned toward me. Angel's eyes closed softly. Tia had cut free most of Megan's clothing, revealing the extent of her wounds. Horrible wounds. It seemed strange that her face was so serene, but I felt like I understood. I felt numb myself. One step after another. I'd carried her back to the hideout. That time was a blur of pain and fright, of aching and dizziness. Prof hadn't offered to help a single time. He'd almost left me behind at several points.
Yeah,
Abraham said to Tia, arriving with another pouch of blood.
Hook it up,
Tia said distractedly, working on Megan's side opposite me. I could see her bloodied surgical gloves reflecting the light. She hadn't had time to change, and her regular clothing, a cardigan over a blouse and jeans, was now stained with streaks of red. She worked with intense concentration, but her voice betrayed panic. Tia's mobile beeped a soft rhythm. It had a medical package, and she had set it on Megan's chest to detect her heartbeat. Tia occasionally picked it up to take quick ultrasounds of Megan's abdomen. With the part of my brain that could still think, I was impressed by the Reckoner's preparations. I hadn't even known that Tia had medical training, let alone that we had blood and surgical equipment in storage. She shouldn't look that way, I thought, blinking out tears I hadn't realized were forming. So vulnerable, naked on the table. Megan is stronger than that. Shouldn't they cover her a little with a sheet or something as they work? I caught myself rising to fetch something to cover her, something to give a semblance of modesty, but then realized how stupid I was being. Each moment was crucial here, and I couldn't go blundering in and distract Tia. I sat down. I was covered in Megan's blood. I couldn't smell it anymore. I guess my nose had gotten used to it. She has to be okay, I thought, dazed. I saved her. I brought her back. She has to be all right now. That's the way it works.
This shouldn't be happening, Abraham said softly. The harm's way,
It doesn't work on everyone, Tia said. I don't know why. I wish I knew why, damn it. But it has never worked well on Megan, just like she always had trouble working the tensors. Stop talking about her weaknesses, I screamed at them in my head. Megan's heartbeat was getting even weaker. I could hear it, amplified by Tia's phone. Beep, beep, beep. Before I knew it, I was standing up. I turned toward Prof's thinking room. Cody hadn't returned to the hideout. He was still watching the captured epic in a separate location, as he'd been ordered. But Prof was here, in the other room. He'd walked straight there after arriving, not once looking at Megan or me. David, Tia said sharply, what are you doing? I stammered, trying to get out the words. I'm going to get Prof. He'll do something. He'll save her. He knows what to do. John can't do anything here, Tia said. Sit back down. The sharp order cut through my dazed confusion. I sat and watched Megan's closed eyes as Tia worked, swearing softly to herself. The curses almost matched the beat of Megan's heart. Abraham stood to the side, looking helpless. I watched her eyes, watched her serene, calm face as the beeps slowed, then stopped. There was no flatline sound from the mobile, just the silence that carried a weight of meaning. Nothingness laden with data. This, I said, blinking tears. I mean, I carried her all the way here, Tia. I'm sorry, Tia said. She raised a hand to her face, leaving a bloody mark on her forehead. Then she sighed and leaned back against the wall, looking exhausted. Do something, I said. Not an order, a plea. I've done what I can, Tia said. She's gone, David. Silence. Those wounds were bad, Tia continued. You did everything you could. It's not your fault. To be honest, even if you'd been able to get her here immediately, I don't know if she'd have made it. I couldn't think. Cloth rustled. I glanced to the side. Prof stood in the doorway to his room. He'd dusted off his clothing, and he looked clean and dignified. A sharp contrast to the rest of us. His eyes flickered to Megan.
She's gone?
He asked. His voice had softened a little from before, though he still didn't sound like I felt he should. Tia nodded.
Gather what you can,
Prof said, slinging a pack over his shoulder.
We're abandoning this position. It's been compromised.
Tia and Abraham nodded, as if they'd been expecting this order. Abraham did pause to lay a hand on Megan's shoulder and bow his head, and then he moved his hand to the pendant at his neck. He hurried off to gather his tools. I took a blanket from Megan's bedroll. It didn't have sheets, and brought it back to lay over her. Prof looked at me, and he seemed about to object to the frivolous action, but he held his tongue. I tucked the blanket around Megan's shoulders, but left her head exposed. I don't know why people cover the face after someone dies. The face is the only thing left that is still right. I brushed it with my fingers. The skin was still warm. This isn't happening, I thought numbly. The Reckoners don't fail like this. Unfortunately, facts, my own facts, flooded my mind. The Reckoners did fail. Members of the Reckoners did die. I researched this. I'd studied this. It happened. It just shouldn't have happened to Megan. I need to see her body cared for, I thought, bending down to pick her up.
Leave the corpse, Prof said.
I ignored him, then felt him gripping my shoulder.
I looked up through bleary eyes and found his expression harsh, eyes wide and angry. They softened as I looked at him.
"What's done is done," Prof said. "We'll burn out this hole, and that will be a fitting burial for her. Regardless, trying to bring the body would just slow us down, maybe get us killed. The soldiers are probably still watching the front position. We can't know how long it will take them to find the new hole I cut in here."
He hesitated.
"She's gone, son."
"I should have run faster," I whispered, in direct contrast to what Tia had said. "I should have been able to save her."
"Are you angry?"
Prof asked.
Abandon the guilt, Prof said. Abandon the denial. Steelheart did this to her. He's our goal. That has to be your focus. We don't have time for grief. We only have time for vengeance.
I found myself nodding. Many would have called those the wrong words, but they worked for me. Prof was right. If I moped and grieved, I'd die. I needed something to replace those emotions, something strong. Anger at Steelheart. That would do it. He'd taken my father from me, and now he'd taken Megan, too. I had a lurking understanding that so long as he lived, he'd take everything I loved from me. Hate Steelheart. Use that to keep me going. Yes, I could do that. I nodded.
"Gather your notes," Prof said, "and then pack up the imager. We're leaving in 10 minutes, and we'll destroy anything we leave behind."
I looked back down the new tunnel Prof had cut into the hideout. Harsh red light glowed at its end. A funeral pyre for Megan. The blast Abraham had rigged was hot enough to melt steel. I could feel the heat from here, far away. If enforcement managed to cut into the hideout, all they'd find would be slag and dust. We had carried out what we could, and Tia had stashed a little more in a hidden pocket she'd had Abraham cut into a nearby corridor. For the second time in a month, I watched a home I'd known burn. This one took something very dear with it. I wanted to say goodbye, to whisper it, or at least think it. I couldn't get the word to form. I guess I just wasn't ready. I turned and followed the others, hiking away into the darkness. An hour later, I was still walking through the dark corridor, head down, pack slung on my back. I was so tired I could barely think. It was odd, though. As strong as my hatred had been for a short time, now it was just lukewarm. Replacing Megan with hatred seemed a poor trade. There was motion ahead, and Tia fell back. She'd changed quickly from her blood-stained clothing. She'd also forced me to do so before abandoning the hideout. I'd washed my hands, too, but there was still blood crusted under my fingernails.
"Hey," Tia said, "you're looking pretty tired."
I shrugged.
"Do you want to talk?"
"Not about her. Just not right now."
"Okay. Then something else, maybe?"
"Something to distract you," her tone implied. "Well, maybe that would be nice. Except the only other thing I wanted to talk about was nearly as distressing. Why is Prof so mad at me?" I asked softly. He looked indignant that he had to come rescue me. That made me sick. When he'd spoken to me via mobile, he'd seemed encouraging, determined to help. And then after, he felt like another person. It lingered with him still as he walked alone at the front of the group. Tia followed my gaze.
"Prof has some bad memories attached to the tensors, David. He hates using them."
"But
he's not mad at you," Tia said. and he's not bothered by having to rescue you, regardless of how it might have seemed. He's mad at himself. He just needs some time alone. But he was so good with them, Tia. I know, she said softly. I've seen it. There are troubles there you can't understand, David. Sometimes doing things we used to do reminds us of who we used to be, and not always in good ways. That didn't make much sense to me. But then, my mind wasn't exactly the most crisp it had ever been. We eventually reached the new bolt hole, which was much smaller than the hideout. Only two small rooms. Cody met us, but spoke with a subdued tone. He'd been briefed, obviously, about what had happened. He helped us carry our equipment up into the main chamber of the new hideout. Conflux, the head of enforcement, was captive in there somewhere. Were we foolhardy to think we could hold him? Was this all part of another trap? I had to assume that Prof and Tia knew what they were doing. As he worked, Abraham flexed his arm, the one that had taken a bullet. The little diodes of the harm sway flashed on his biceps, and the bullet holes had scabbed over already. A night sleeping with those diodes on, and he'd be able to use the arm without trouble in the morning. A few days, and the wound would only be a scar. And yet, I thought, handing my pack to Cody and crawling through the tunnel to the upper chamber. It didn't help Megan. Nothing we did helped Megan. I had lost a lot of people in the last 10 years. Life in New Cago wasn't easy, particularly for orphans. But none of those losses had affected me this profoundly since my father's death. I guess it was a good thing. It meant I was learning to care again. Still, it felt pretty crappy at the moment. When I came out of the entry tunnel and into the new hideout, Prof was telling everyone to bed down for the night. He wanted us to have some sleep in us before we dealt with the captive epic. As I arranged my bedroll, I heard him speaking with Cody and Tia. Something about injecting the captive epic with a sedative so that he remained unconscious. David, Tia asked, you're wounded. I should hook up the harm sway to you and... I'll live, I said. They could heal me tomorrow. I didn't care at the moment. Instead, I lay down on my bedroll and turned over to face the wall. Then I finally let the tears come in force. 32. About 16 hours later, I sat on the floor of the new hideout, eating a bowl of oatmeal sprinkled with raisins, harm sway diodes flashing on my leg and side. We'd had to leave most of our good food behind and were relying on storage that had been packed in the bolt hole. The other Reckoners gave me space. I found that odd, since they'd all known Megan longer than I had. It wasn't like she and I had actually shared anything special, even if she had begun warming up to me. In fact, as I looked back on it, my reaction to her death seemed silly. I was just a boy with a crush. It still hurt, though. Badly.
Hey, Prof, Cody said, sitting in front of a laptop. You should see this, mate. Mate? Prof asked.
I've got a little bit of Australian in me, Cody said. My father's grandfather was one quarter Aussie. Been meaning to try it out for a spin.
You're a bizarre little man, Cody,
Prof said. He was back to his normal self, for the most part. Maybe a little more solemn today. So were the rest of them, even Cody. Losing a teammate wasn't a pleasant experience, though I got the sense that they'd been through all of this before. Prof studied the screen for a moment, then raised an eyebrow. Cody tapped, then tapped again.
What is it?
Tia asked. Cody turned the laptop around. None of us had chairs. We were all just sitting on our bedrolls. Even though this hideout was smaller than the other, it felt empty to me. There weren't enough of us. The screen was blue, with simple block letters in black. Pick a time and location.
I will come.
This, Cody said, is all people can see on any of the 100 entertainment channels in Steelheart's network. It's displayed on every mobile that logs on, and on every information screen in the city. Something makes me think we got through to him.
Prof smiled.
This is good. He's letting us pick the place for the fight.
He usually does that, I said, staring into my oatmeal. He let Faultline choose. He thinks it sends a message. This city is his, and he doesn't care if you try to find a place that gives you the better ground. He'll kill you anyway.
I just wish I didn't feel blind, Tia said.
She was sitting in the far corner with her data pad. It had her mobile stuck to the back, so its display expanded what was on the mobile's screen.
It's baffling. How did they find out that I'd hacked their camera system? I'm locked out on all sides, every hole plugged. I can't see a thing of what's going on in the city.
We'll pick a place where we can set up our own cameras,
Prof said.
You won't be blind when we face him, Tia. It.
Abraham's mobile beeped. He raised it up.
Proximity alarms say that our prisoner is stirring, Prof. Good,
Prof said, standing up and looking toward the entrance to the smaller room that held our captive.
That mystery has been itching at me all day.
As he turned, his eyes fell on me, and I caught a flash of guilt from him. He moved past me quickly and began giving orders. We'd interrogate the prisoner with a light shining directly on him, Cody standing behind him with a gun to the Epic's head. Everyone was to wear their jackets. They'd replaced mine with a spare. It was black leather, too large for me by a size or two. The reckoners began moving to set things up. Cody and Tia entered the prisoner's room, eventually followed by Prof. I shoved a spoonful of oatmeal in my mouth, then noticed Abraham, who was lingering in the main room. He walked over to me and knelt on one knee.
Live, David, he said softly. Live your life.
I'm doing that, I grumbled.
No. You're letting Steelheart live your life for you. He controls it, each step of the way. Live your own life.
He patted my shoulder, as if that made everything all right, then waved for me to come with him into the next room. I sighed, climbed to my feet, and followed. The captive was a spindly older man, perhaps in his 60s, balding and dark-skinned. He was turning his head about, trying to figure out where he was, though he was still blindfolded and gagged. He certainly didn't look threatening, strapped into his chair as he was. Of course, many an unthreatening epic could kill with little more than a thought. Conflux wasn't supposed to have powers like that, but then Fortuity wasn't supposed to have had heightened dexterity. Besides, we didn't even know if this was Conflux. I found myself pondering the situation, which was good. At least it kept me from thinking about her. Abraham aimed a large floodlight right at the captive's face. Many epics needed line of sight to use their powers on someone, so keeping the man disoriented had a very real and useful purpose. Prof nodded to Cody, who cut off the prisoner's blindfold and gag, then stepped back and leveled a wicked 357 at the man's head. The prisoner blinked against the light, then looked about. He cringed in his chair.
Who are you?
Prof asked, standing by the light where the prisoner wouldn't be able to make out his features.
Edmund Sense, the prisoner said. He paused. And you? That is not important to you. Well, seeing as how you have me captive, I suspect it's of utmost importance to me.
Edmund had a pleasant voice with a faint Indian accent. He seemed nervous. His eyes kept darting from side to side.
You're an epic,
Prof said.
Yes, Edmund answered. They call me Conflux. Head of Steelheart's enforcement troops,
Prof said. The rest of us remained quiet, as instructed, to not give the man an indication of how many were in the room. Edmund chuckled.
Ed? Yes, I suppose you could call me that.
He leaned back, closing his eyes.
Though more appropriately, I might be the heart. Or maybe just the battery.
Why were you in the trunk of that car?
Prof asked.
Because I was being transported.
And you suspected your limo might be attacked, so you hid yourself in the trunk?
Young man,
Edmund said pleasantly,
if I had wanted to hide, would I have had myself tied up, gagged, and blindfolded?
Prof was silent.
You wish for proof that I am who I say, Edmund said with a sigh. Well, I'd rather not force you to beat it out of me. Do you have a mechanical device that has been drained of energy? No battery power at all?
Prof looked to the side. Tia fished in her pocket and handed over a penlight. Prof tried it, and no light came out. Then he hesitated. Finally, he waved us out of the room. Cody remained, gun on Edmund, but the rest of us, Prof included, gathered in the main chamber.
He might be able to overload it and make it explode,
Prof said softly.
We will need proof of who he is, though, Tia said. If he can power that by touching it, then he's either Conflux or a different epic with a very similar power.
Or someone who Conflux gifted his abilities to, I said.
He registers as a powerful epic on the Dowser, Abraham said. We've tried it on enforcement officers before who had powers given to them by Conflux, and it didn't register them.
What if he's a different epic?
Tia asked,
with some powers gifted by Conflux to show he can give energy to things and make us think he's Conflux. He could act harmless, then, when we aren't expecting, turn his full powers on us.
Prof slowly shook his head.
I don't think so. That's just too convoluted and too dangerous. Why would they think we would decide to kidnap Conflux? We could just as easily have killed him right there when we found him. I think this man is who he says he is. Why was he in the trunk, though?
Abraham asked.
He'll probably answer if we ask him, I said. I mean, he hasn't exactly been difficult so far. That's what worries me, Tia said. It's too easy.
Easy? I asked. Megan died so we could capture that guy. I want to hear what he has to say.
Prof glanced at me, tapping the penlight against his palm. He nodded, and Abraham fetched a long wooden rod, which we tied the light to. We returned to the room, and Prof used the rod to touch the light to Edmund's cheek. Immediately, the flashlight's bulb started glowing. Edmund yawned, then tried to settle himself in his bonds. Prof pulled the flashlight back. It continued to shine.
I recharged the battery for you, Edmund said. Might that be enough to persuade you to get me a drink?
2 years ago, I said, stepping forward despite Prof's orders. In July, you were involved in a large-scale project on Steelheart's behalf. What was it?
I don't really have a good sense of time, the man said.
It shouldn't be hard to remember, I said. The people of the city don't know about it, but something odd happened to Conflux.
Summer,
Was that when I was taken out of the city? Edmund smiled. Yes, I remember the sunlight. He needed me to power some of his war tanks for some reason.
It had been an offensive against Dialus, an epic in Detroit who had angered Steelheart by cutting off some of his food supplies. Conflux's part had been handled very covertly. Few knew of it. Prof was looking at me, lips drawn to a tight line. I ignored him.
Edmund, I said, you came to the city on what date?
Spring of 04 AC, he said.
4 years after Calamity. That clinched it for me. Most people assumed that Conflux had joined Steelheart in 05 AC, when Enforcement had first gained mechanized units and the power outages of 04 AC had finally begun to stabilize.
But inside sources that I'd carefully gathered claimed Steelheart hadn't trusted Complux at first and hadn't used him for important projects for nearly a year. As I looked at this man, a lot of things from my notes about Complux were starting to make sense. Why was Complux never seen? Why was he transported as he was? Why the shroud, the mystery? It wasn't just because of Complux's frailty. "You're a prisoner," I said.
"Of course he is,"
Prof said, but Complux nodded. "No," I said to Prof. "He's always been a prisoner. Steelheart isn't using him as a lieutenant, but as a power source. Complux isn't in charge of enforcement. He's just
a battery," Edmund said. "A slave. It's all right, you can say it. I'm quite accustomed to it. I'm a valuable slave, which is actually an enviable position. I suspect it won't be too long before he finds us and kills you all for taking me."
He grimaced.
"I am sorry about that. I hate it terribly when people fight over me."
"All this time," I said. "Sparks." Steelheart couldn't let it be known what he was doing to Complux. In New Kago, epics were all but sacred. The more powerful they were, the more rights they had. It was the foundation of the government. The epics lived by the pecking order because they knew, even if they were at the bottom, they were still far more important than the ordinary people. But here was an epic who was a slave, nothing more than a power plant. This had huge ramifications for everyone in New Kago. Steelheart was a liar. I guess I shouldn't be too surprised, I thought. I mean, after everything else he's done, this is a minor issue. Still, it seemed important. Or maybe I was just latching on to the first thing that drew my attention away from Megan.
"Shut it down,"
Prof said.
"Excuse me," Edmund said. "Shut down what?"
"You're a gifter," Prof said. "A transference epic. Draw your power back from the people you've given it to. Remove it from the mechanized armors, the copters, the power stations. I want you to cut off every person you've granted your power."
"If I do that," Edmund said hesitantly, "Steelheart will not be pleased with me when he recovers me."
"You can tell him the truth,"
Prof said, raising a handgun in one hand so that it pointed out in front of the spotlight.
"If I kill you, the power will go away. I'm not afraid to take that step. Recover your power, Edmund. Then we'll talk further."
"Very well," Edmund said. And just like that, he all but shut down New Kago.
33.
"I don't really think of myself as an epic," Edmund said, leaning forward across the makeshift table. We'd made it out of a box and a plank, and we sat on the floor to eat at it. "I was captured and used for power only a month after my transformation. Bastion was my first owner's name. I tell you, was he unpleasant after we discovered I couldn't transfer my power to him?"
"Why do you suppose that is?" I asked, chewing on some jerky.
"I don't know," Edmund said, raising his hands in front of himself. He liked to gesture a lot when he talked. You had to watch yourself, lest you get an accidental ninja punch to the shoulder during a particularly emphatic exclamation about the taste of a good curry. That was about as dangerous as he got. Though Cody stayed near, his rifle never too far from him, Edmund hadn't been the least bit provocative. He actually seemed pleasant, at least when he wasn't mentioning our inevitable gruesome deaths at Steelheart's hands. "That's the way it has always worked for me," Edmund continued, pointing at me with his spoon. "I can only gift them to ordinary humans, and I have to touch them to do it. I've never been able to give my powers to an epic. I've tried."
Nearby, Prof, who had been carrying some supplies past, stopped in place. He turned to Edmund.
"What was that you said?"
"I can't gift to other epics," Edmund said, shrugging. "It's just the way the powers work."
Is it that way for other gifters?
Prof asked. I've never met any, Edmund said. Gifters are rare. If there are others in the city, Steelheart never let me meet them. He wasn't bothered by not being able to get my powers for himself.